On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation, cussing, and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! A minute and a half past the hour, this is Thorn in the Side Thursday on the Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is our home. That's where you go for the Listen Live button. That's where you go for the various fun and interactive features of this little last thread of a freeing shoestring operation. Things like the chat room. Pop on in. The room is filling up. No limits. And it's free and easy. Good evening, Mr. Gibson. Good evening, Sparky. Thanks going out to Mr. Gibson and our buddy Horst for joining in with Robert from Australia last night to help us get over some of the fundraising hump. Let's see. So last night, three goes into and you'd butt and you'd carry 12. And we got a hole to dig out of. Let's just get that out of the way, because also at HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is the PayPal button. That's how we keep this little thing going. I get sick of saying it. Y'all get sick of hearing it. But it's the only thing that makes this work. We put out of our own pocket into this effort, as do you. And that's what has made it last as long as it has. You know, we're coming up on the 9th anniversary of this. We passed the 10th anniversary of me coming back to radio. Not that there was any fanfare or parades or anything. But no, it's lasted for 10 years on a model that people said, "Oh, that'll never work. You gotta go for the profit. It's gotta be profit-based." I mean, I remember when Ed Schultz demeaned the people in Phoenix who were trying to keep their progressive radio station on the air by calling it bake sale radio. Yeah, if you're not playing in the fields of the profit-driven economy, people think there's something wrong with you. It's like you're some sort of an economic atheist. I don't know. It reminded me of something that Joe Bagent wrote. Joe is never far from my thoughts. And Joe once wrote a piece. Joe Bagent once wrote a piece called Waltzing at the Doomsday Ball. And there's something very, very special about it. Because, among other things, it really sort of nails right down to the ground the economic essence of what's going on here. Waltzing at the Doomsday Ball. Look it up. Dang it. There we go. Here it is. Just a couple of words from this, just to remind you how damn brilliant he was. Waltzing at the Doomsday Ball. Capitalism is dead, but we still dance with the corpse. As an Anglo-European white guy from a very long line of white guys, I want to thank all the brown, black, yellow, and red people for a marvelous three-century joyride. During the past 300 years, the Industrial Age, as Europeans and later as Americans, we have managed to consume infinitely more than we ever produced, thanks to colonialism, crooked deals with despotic potentates, and good old gunboats and grapeshot. Yes, we have lived and still live extravagant lifestyles far above the rest of you, and so my sincere thanks to all of you folks around the world working in sweatshops or living on $2 a day, even though you sit on vast oil deposits. And to those outside my window here in Mexico this morning, the two guys pruning the retired gringo's hedges with what look like pocket knives, I say keep up the good work. It's the world's cheap labor guys like you, the black, brown, and yellow folks who take it up the shorts, who make capitalism look like it actually works. So keep on humping. Remember, we've got predator drones. And after that little bit of snark, he goes into some really fairly serious stuff. He quotes a man he describes as my friend, physicist and political activist George Saltzman. Everyone in these professional institutions dealing in money lives a fundamentally dishonest life. Never mind regulating interest rates, he says. We must do away with interest, with the very idea of money making money. We must recognize that what is termed Western civilization, pay attention here, we must recognize that what is termed Western civilization is in fact an anti-civilization, a global social structure of death and destruction. However, the charade of ever-increasing debt can be kept up only as long as the public remains ignorant. Once ecological limits have been reached, the capitalist political game is up. Waltzing at the Doomsday Ball, also the name of the book that is an ingathering of the very finest of Joe's essays. And so, no, we don't play that game here. We don't play that game at all. This is not a profit-driven enterprise. This is an enterprise about creating a space whereby we can all come together and engage in conversation, share thoughts, sometimes just yawp, and sometimes we laugh, and sometimes we talk about food porn, and sometimes we talk about more serious things, and sometimes we poke fun at the religion industry and so forth. Yeah. But all of those things happen because you are determined to make them happen. And so it is that we need to raise $380 tonight. 38 folks, $10 apiece. PayPal button is at headonradionetwork.com. So too is the traditional mail address, which is, I will repeat here now, The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, Beckley, WV 25801. A gentle reminder to anyone using the traditional mail method, don't make any checks or money orders payable to Bob Kincaid, as they don't come to Bob Kincaid, they go to pay the bills. And that's something that Boss Man Wayne handles, and he doesn't like signing Bob Kincaid on things because it makes him feel kind of icky. Just make it to Head On Communications. Okie doke. So $38, $10 apiece, and that'll take care of what we fell short on last night, what we need to raise tonight, and what we need to raise for tomorrow night when I will actually be in Madison, Wisconsin. But it's all predicated on this notion of it all, the law. It's long division, and I get lost. But that's where we are. 38 people, $10 apiece, and thank you very much. And with any luck, that will make it possible when I get back from Madison that we'll have a show next week, at least Monday and Tuesday, because then I'll be gone to Texas for the Waco Friends of Peace meeting, to which I have been cordially invited. And well, it's going the name of the name of what I'm going to be talking about is Who Needs Cruise Missiles? An Introduction to Appalachia's Agony. And who needs them indeed? Well, America needs them, that's who. Because we've got people to bomb, things to do and people to bomb. Eesh. Thanks, Henry. Thank you very much. We now need 37 folks. 37 folks, $10 apiece. Thanks for getting us started this evening, Henry. Yeah, fighting Bob Fett. And by the way, just a note, I'm going to... communications have not been what I would like for them to be. But you may recall that last year I was able to stream the entirety of Fighting Bob from the Alliance Center in Madison, Wisconsin. And I hope I will be able to do the same again. So start checking things out. Oh, I'd say, what, about 10 o'clock in the morning, 11 o'clock Eastern Time, 8 o'clock Pacific, etc., etc. Hopefully we'll just be streaming the entirety of Fighting Bob and making that available to folks who couldn't otherwise be there. That's the hope. Fingers crossed. also looking to see if it may be possible to stream the event in Waco, and our buddy Dr. Allen is looking into that as well. If possible, I think it'd be really cool. So there's that. About 11 minutes past the hour as we begin this Thorn in the Side Thursday. And nothing says Thorn in the Side Thursday like, well, y'all do. Got a couple of brilliant emails here that came in the course of the last, 12 hours or so. And the first one comes from our buddy Horst, who dropped this note after the program ended last night, and I couldn't therefore share it with you at the time. But this is one of those moments where you go, "Dang, he's not kidding. This really is the smartest radio audience on the internet, and certainly on terrestrial radio." And mega dittos for Busted Knuckle Rush. I want to tweak your nose. I'm going to name my next heifer calf after you, Rush. Yeah. Horst wanted you to, he didn't say, "Bob, would you please?" No, this just begs Sharon. And you can tell that there's a certain amount of humility attached because it begins with an apology. I wish you guys would stop that. Don't apologize for it. When you're just cranking out a whole bunch of brilliance, don't apologize for it, please. Horst writes, "Hey, Bob, generally I try not to send an email until I've had a chance to listen to the latest podcast, because quite often I discover afterwards that my comments or observations are redundant. Never. But it's been a long time since I've written anything of substance, and with my son just having started first grade this week..." Everybody, collectively, aww. Because I remember that day. And I'm sure y'all do too at some point, either your own or kids or grandkids. Aww. Although maybe it's not quite as terrifying sending for Horst, since he is offshore. Maybe it's not quite the horror that sending them off into our flagging, failing public schools is. Our flagging, failing public schools where we have to teach the controversy, and tell children that, "Well, yes, the scientists do say that the theory of evolutionism control is determined by, and yeah, that's what they say, but we got to teach the controversy, and it's entirely possible that Adam and Eve rode a dinosaur to church every Sunday in the Garden of Eden until Eve screwed it up for poor old Adam." Yeah. Anyway, "With my son just having started first grade this week, while I resume attending classes myself after a six-month absence, I'm a bit worn out these days and unlikely to get around to writing later. I was going to write this to you yesterday, but when the time came to sit down and do it, I didn't have the mental energy. I've got another email to Dr. Bill that's been on the back burner for a couple of months, incidentally. Move that thing to the front, Horst. That'll tickle Dr. Bill pink. It'll probably be the subject of an entire program, if I know Dr. Bill. I've been meaning," Horst continues, "to run this idea past you since President Obama announced that he was going to take his case for action in Syria to Congress. Like you, I find the ecstatic reaction among Obama supporters and the notion that this is the greatest trap ever for the Jews..." Wait. "And the notion that this is the greatest trap ever for the GOP silly in the extreme. I've heard some of your reasoning on the subject, and no doubt we'll hear more later today when I get to hear the podcast, and I'd like to take a minute to share mine. In short, I think the president has just handed the House GOP his own head, and all that remains to be seen is if they're cunning enough to recognize the offer. And here's why. We know the GOP is itching to get us involved militarily in the Middle East, generally, and have long been salivating at the perceived opportunity for involvement in Syria. The record is extensive and uncontroversial on this point. We also know that the GOP is equally anxious to do anything they can to damage Obama politically, no matter what the cost to the nation, or even to themselves as a national party. This is especially true of the House GOP, where, thanks to extensive gerrymandering, the craziest of the Tea Party contingent actually strengthen themselves politically with insane and stupid actions. We know all of this as surely as we know our own names. even those of us who aren't all that particular about names and keep extras handy, like umbrellas or overcoats. Anyway, the new authorization for the use of military force, OMF, you know, until Iraq came along, we never had OMFs. Couldn't they make it spell something? Like, you know, financing a universal consensus on Kriegs, German word for war. Yeah, that spells. You know what that spells. Anyway, the new OMF should sail past the Senate, but it's interesting to know that Marco Rubio and Rand Paul, libertarian ophthalmologist, voted against it in committee. Rand Paul is on the Foreign Relations Committee. Huh? What? And Ted Cruz has consistently made noises against it. This gives us an indication of where the nutbag and wannabe contingent sentiments lie and where the vote in the House is headed. Basically, the House is going to vote against the OMF. Why? Because President Obama himself has told them in advance that he's going to strike Syria no matter how Congress votes. That means that the House crazies get to have their war and poke yet another thumb in the president's eye. And best of all, they get a gift straight from the president himself that beats the daylights out of yet another vote to repeal Obamacare. They get to start impeachment proceedings. Who's going to stop them? They've already had the votes for years. They've just been waiting for a charge that'll stick long enough for the proceedings to go through. They tried to drum up outrage with the so-called IRS, Benghazi, and Fast and Furious scandals. And in fact, that one goober from South Carolina, Stan, naturally, raised all three of those just yesterday. But so far, they've been unable for that outrage to extend beyond the borders of their own fever swamp. NB, nota bene, I see today that they're already ramping up noise about all these past outrages, plainly attempting to create an illusion of a scandal-plagued administration. That probably called for a little reverb, too, to strengthen the case for impeachment. Syria will be different, because this time the left is going to help them. You, I, and approximately nine other people do remember that news of NSA spying, which was still illegal at the time, broke almost 10 years ago, conveniently after the 2004 election. But to the rest of what I used to consider the informed public, NSA spying and intelligence outsourcing was invented personally by Barack Hussein Obama. Apparently, many of these same people have decided that if Obama takes military action in Syria without congressional approval, it will be a... usurpation of constitutional powers! Unprecedented in the history of the Republic. Well, I mean, unprecedented, if by unprecedented we mean George W. Bush did it, George H.W. Bush did it, Bill Clinton did it, Ronald Reagan did it, Lyndon Johnson did it. Everybody but Jimmy Carter did it. Yeah, that kind of unprecedented. I've been hearing and reading, Horst continues, for weeks from various non-right-wing figures that they would support impeachment in just such an event. If the House GOP acts as I expect, that event will be coming as early as next week. There are only two reasons I can see why this would fail to happen. One, either the GOP is too stupid to recognize the opportunity, or two, the potential symbolism of a vote for military action during next week's anniversary of 9/11 will present a temptation too strong for the bloodthirsty GOP to resist. And I think that really is, that's a toss-up right there. Either one of those can obtain. Whether or not events shake out as I've drafted here, make a note of how easily it could. And how this outcome is only possible because the president telegraphed his intentions to strike Syria in advance of the actual vote in Congress. If he had left himself any wiggle room, then perhaps the GOP would have found themselves in a tough, maybe even lose-lose situation. Remember that the next time you find yourself wondering about 11-dimensional chess. If the GOP acts true to the nature and character that they've shown to date, impeachment is just around the corner. And the only remaining question is whether or not Roberts will follow Rehnquist's example and slap some racing stripes on his robe for the event. Signed, your pal, Horst. P.S. I enjoyed the takedown of Victor Davis Hanson, but it took me a while to figure out who he was. I recognized the name, but for the life of me, I could have sworn he was one of Jack Canfield's buddies from the New Age billionaire self-help guru lecture circuit. Chicken soup for the neoliberal fascist soul, anyone? Yeah. I'd say Horst went out, skinned pelt, and nailed that pelt to the door with that, wouldn't you? Because it's all true. From here on out, man, it ain't silly season. It's like the silly, it's the sillapocalypse. Or the apocalypsily. Yesterday, the goob from South Carolina stand served notice that it was the sillapocalypse, or the apocalypsily. What I want to know, Senator Kerry, is whether or not you've promised to tell us the truth. Damn lying Yankee. Why didn't he just get up and come across the table and beat him a little bit like that other the heathen from South Carolina did 151 or 2 years ago? Nearly beat Charles Sumner to death. It's what they want to do. Good God, you've got a county in California that's trying to raise up a secession fever out there. Trying to get some counties in southern Oregon and counties in northern California to come together and form a separate state because they're tired of that liberal nanny state California, Oregon, and they you know, free it. Daggum it, when sprinklers are outlawed, only outlaws will have sprinklers. Yeah. And then we got two brilliant emails in one day. And they are certainly worth the time. This next one comes from Chris in California, who notes yesterday, meaning yesterday, and referring to Tuesday's program, yesterday I was listening to that piece of highfalutin nonsense penned by that inestimable hack, Venereal Disease Hansen, or whatever his name was. Oh, yeah. That you read on the program. It never ceases to amaze me how smart, stupid people can sound with enough fancy words and arrogance. And yet, when you look at the edifice that is this essay, no offense meant to real essayists, you simply have to examine the foundations of said edifice to realize that about a dozen ignorant, if not benightedly downright wrong assumptions are made before you even set eyes on word one. I apologize for lumping people into two categories for this point I'm trying to make. I know the reality is a bit more complex, but bear with me. There are smart people, and there are stupid people. Stupid person bashing is one of the most psychologically satisfying, but ultimately pointless things that smart people engage in, because while we sit around and gawk at how hollow and meaningless this collection of sentences by V.D. Hanson is, there are far more people. Everybody, clap for V.D. Hanson. Clap for V.D. Hanson. Get it? Clap. V.D. Got it? Okay. While we sit around and gawk at how hollow and meaningless this collection of sentences by V.D. Hanson is, there are far more people who, upon reading this and comprehending little, think that the right wing has struck yet another intellectual blow against the left. I know he is ostensibly a Democrat, and I don't care. What is the defining characteristic that smart people have that stupid people do not? I don't think it's necessarily raw IQ. To the extent that a higher gross intelligence may result in a higher likelihood of developing self-awareness and critical thinking, people who are just plain brilliant probably have a huge leg up. But I'm long past the point of defining intelligence by book learning. We all know people who have read tons of books and learned nothing substantial, as well as people who have drunk deep from the well of life and carefully learned from their experiences, picking up few books, but developing a more comprehensive outlook than many academics ever could. In my mind, the main problem with stupid people is not that they are stupid per se, but that they don't know that they're stupid. Or, to put it a bit more kindly, they are unaware of their own limitations. And suddenly we find ourselves wandering around ancient Athens with a guy whose nickname meant broad shoulders, Platon. His pals called him Plato, and he wrote about his teacher, who said that the unexamined life is not worth living. And unexamining life is almost exclusively the province of the stupid people that Chris is writing about here. In my mind, Chris continues, the main problem with stupid people is not that they are stupid per se, but that they don't know they're stupid. Or, to put it a bit more kindly, they are unaware of their own limitations. I know this is a bit of a pop culture example, but Forrest Gump was incredibly inspiring for this reason, because it shows that when a person has true self-awareness, their supposed lack of intelligence does not have to be a hindrance, i.e., when Forrest cleans and reloads his gun 3 times faster than anyone else, simply because he was told to. I love that scene. It's almost like we need a new word, because stupid and smart are too much of a write-off. They smack too much of the brutal education system, which purposely subdivides all students by their ability to more or less memorize massive quantities of information, and labels those that cannot do so bad students, or dumb, or what have you. Or ADD, or ADHD, or... yeah. My criteria for intelligence are primarily self-awareness and also critical thinking. Isn't it a bit ironic in such an individual-obsessed culture so few individuals really know themselves? These two criteria are interrelated. Critical thinking, once learned, can be turned on the self to develop self-awareness. Or if one has self-awareness and an understanding of one's own limitations, it can lead to an understanding of the necessary limitations of others and give rise to critical thinking. It's a bit hubristic of me to put this all out on the table so simply, and it's not as if I have a clear idea of exactly how or when I develop these qualities. I suspect it is always an ongoing process of refinement. Absolutely. That's what I was talking about the other night when I said, I can't, with a handful of exceptions, I can't tell you I learned this then. Just as you probably can't either. I can rattle off in the space of a couple of minutes the names of a host of magnificent teachers that I was fortunate enough to have as a public school kid. But to say that you can't catalog that learning, because it's a cumulative experience, a willingness to continue learning through life. Like Chris says, I suspect it is always an ongoing process of refinement. If you are information poor and never learned these skills, and tend to act on the strength of your convictions rather than on actual gathered data, I can only imagine that you would vote for a similar light-on-the-facts person because you have no connection to the process of correlating facts and trying to convince people with rational arguments. Even though I'm sure this sounded arrogant as hell, I have great sympathy for those who have this situation thrust upon them. Our horrendous education system, lack of opportunities for the poor, and mind-numbing consumer culture have created a huge number of self-centered yet self-unaware consumption-driven people that have bought into the system hook, line, and sinker. I guess this is a place where editorially I might note, yes, really, go back to joebagent, joebagent.com and read Waltzing at the Doomsday Ball, and then read America, Why Your Peeps Be So Dumb. Back to what Chris says. I truly believe this form of stupidity is deliberately engineered and inculcated in the populace. Or if not deliberately, then we refuse to take responsibility for the chaos caused by our incompetence. And here I sit, wanting to just grab the nearest right-winger and shake them and scream, "Wake up!" There are 1,000 hacking at the branches of evil to one who is striking at the root. Henry David Thoreau. I'd like to think, Chris says, we in the Horn family commune are at least trying to find those roots. Regards, Chris, in California. Just wow. Inquiries into the nature of knowledge. Inquiries into the nature of why political animals behave as they do. More actual thought in 30 minutes of this program than has ever existed in the 20 or 30 years that, for instance, a certain junkie gas bag has been on the AM airwaves. Wow. More ingathered brains between Horst and Chris than more functioning neurons, synapses, than will ever fire in the entire existence of a charlatan like David Barton, or a hate-filled crook like Chappie Gordon Klingenschmidt. You know, a couple of million units of penicillin will clear up that Klingenschmidt. Dr. John, with a note, subject line, teaching the controversy. When I teach evolution, I bottle up the fundies early on. First, the scientific method. Second, what is a fact? Third, a list of facts. Gravity, death, and evolution. Then this, and note the language. I'm not interested in arguing with anyone who has been socialized to reject evolution as a way of explaining the origins and diversity of life on Earth. As an anthropologist, I recognize that as humans, we all hold some ideas to be beyond question. That's fine. For the purpose of this class, you'll need to understand the material and apply it in papers, quizzes, exams, and class discussions. Anyone who has a problem is welcome to speak with me privately. Dr. John notes, to date, no takers. Dr. John concludes saying, from what I can tell, these kids think of evolution as forbidden fruit. They've never really learned what it is. Only that it's bad. Bad, I tell you, bad! And thus, fascinating. Which is, indeed, good news for our future. Whatever that future may turn out to be. And, you know, therein lies the rub. Because, well, the whole Syria thing really does say it. Oh, I know. They say they're going to bomb a couple of runways and be done. You believe that? Because I don't. I just don't. And I say I don't believe that not because I disbelieve, you know, I'm not sitting there next to the goober from South Carolina standing saying, Secretary Kerry, are you going to tell us the truth this time? No. I think wars themselves have a way of getting to be nastier than what we may ever think they can be. Truth is the first casualty of war. Anybody? Who said that? I don't really. Who said that? I'll be told in a minute. Sounds kind of Clausewitz-y, doesn't it? Maybe it's not. Hey, thanks, Brian. Thanks very much. Brian just chipped in. We now need 36 people at $10 apiece to wrap things up for the week. Thanks for your loyalty to your listeners, says Brian. And I think he means thanks for your loyalty to your listeners. In other words, thanks for your loyalty to the Horn Family Commune. Thanks indeed. And thanks for being a part of that, Brian. So we find ourselves, you know, in a mess. We're going to go to war, whether we like it or not. And meanwhile, the problems are going to continue to pile up back here at home. Because as we contemplate throwing some several hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars in explosives. You know, here, at the tender age of 50, I find myself understanding my father more and more. As a kid, I loved fireworks. Firecrackers, bottle rockets, Roman candles, you name it. At one point, they even had this one little firecracker, and for some reason or another, they managed to sell it on over-the-counter at this little, and they were illegal. But you would strike it on a matchbox. It didn't have a fuse as such, and then it would be a smoke bomb, and then it would be a firecracker. It was really, you know, a really, really awesome little firework. And once you had, you know, gotten it started and it was smoking, you could even drop it in water and it would explode underwater. Too cool. I loved them. I loved them better than candy. I loved them better than chocolate. Better than bubble gum. I could stand for hours just with a metal wash tub in the backyard full of water, just and dropping them in. And then after you built your model ships, you could and get it and stick it on the bottom of the Missouri and send it across the wash tub. And oh no, look out for the mine! Bang! And then you have to cut lawns for a couple more weeks to save enough money to buy a new model of the Missouri. And well, I blew up the Prinzlagen. I blew up the Bismarck. I think I blew up every model ship that was out there. But anyway, I love fireworks. And my father hated fireworks. He'd look at me and say, "But you can't eat it. You can't drink it. It won't keep you warm in the winter or cool you off in the summer. It will not do anything for you. It is without value." But I still wanted the damned fireworks. And it has taken approximately, I'd say, 30 years for that fascination to go away. But earlier today, when I was contemplating that in the name of we the people of the United States, who are working desperately to form that more perfect union, and we do it every day, that we have people in government who are still fascinated with fireworks. We are literally... "Son," my dad would say, I might as well give you the money and we'll just stand out in the backyard and set it on fire. And cut out the middleman. Well, isn't that what we're doing? No, this is humanitarian. Oh, I got you. Right. These are humanitarian explosives. Man, that's an oxymoron right up there with military intelligence. Jumbo shrimp. Oh, thank you, Dr. John. Oh, the internet say it was Aeschylus? Okay. That would make sense. That kind of has a Peloponnesian flavor to it. But we really are. We're going to do that, aren't we? We're going to take some several millions, if not hundreds of millions, if not billions of dollars... Because, well, the Pentagon hasn't really run the numbers. It's much easier to run the numbers after you've already spent the money and say you need more. And we're going to light the fuses under some cruise missiles. And it's going to be really cool. And the embedded reporters in Damascus and other parts, you know, the people, you know, CNN and Fox, you know, and they've already paid their stringers and they got the cameras set up and they got their night vision cameras because we'll do it at night because we like to attack by night. Just like a vampire. And they'll have really cool footage and music dum-diddly-dum-diddly-dum-diddly-dum-dum-dum-dum that cost a fortune and really splashy graphics. War in Syria. Wait a minute. Who am I kidding? War in Syria. dum diddly dum diddly dum diddly dum 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 dum. Yeah. And so why not? I mean, let's say to President Not Sure and anybody else who supports this idea of blasting the bejesus out of Syria for reasons that don't really offer any cogent explanation. Hey, guys, just pile up the $1 billion on the White House lawn, let's set it on fire, and cut out the middleman. Oh, that really pisses the boys at Raytheon off. Wait a minute, damn it! We're the middleman! But we're gonna do it. We're going to do it as Texas is added to the list of other states that are grinding up their paved roads and returning them to gravel. We're going to do it as Loudoun County, Virginia. Remember Loudoun County, Virginia? We talked about Loudoun County, Virginia a while back. This is the richest single county in the United States. And number two ain't even close, if my reading is correct. It's not like they battle back and forth on an annual basis. Loudoun County, Virginia, is the richest single county in the United States. I think if I recall our discussion with Rochelle, the Loudoun County budget approaches $1 billion a year. A single American county with revenues of $1 billion per year. Well, you may recall that Loudoun County, Virginia, wanted, you know, because damn history people going to museums, just history moochers. They wanted to close the county museum because, you know, who needs one? I mean, you want to go to a museum, go to Richmond. Loudoun County, Virginia, their museum got a bit of a reprieve. I haven't had an update from Rochelle in a while, and I probably need one. But it turns out that Loudoun County, Virginia, is hell-bent on wiping out public school bus routes. They are cutting the bus routes so as to eliminate school bus accessibility.
More than you expect for a...
Oh, I don't... Yeah, because I want to... That was an advertisement being run by ABC7. WJLA.com, who in classic for-profit media speak say, in a cost-saving measure, Loudoun County schools this year eliminated bus routes for the more than 4,000 students who live less than a mile from school. At Stonebridge High School in Ashburn, that means a lot of dangerous jaywalking. Yeah. 4,000 students just got screwed out of a bus ride. The richest county in the United States. And, of course, it's a high-traffic area. So that means at some point in time, somebody's kid is going to get run over and killed. Not predicting, just noting that the law of averages kind of says that's going to happen. So, just to review, a county with a budget that approaches $1 billion a year has eliminated bus rides for 4,000 eager young scholars but we're going to lob a few $100 million worth of fireworks. Very disastrously dangerous fireworks, but fireworks nonetheless. They all go back to the same common source, you know, the invention of gunpowder by the Chinese. Yeah, we're going to lob, right. Because that's the way our priorities run in these here new United States. We have money for bombs, but not for bread. We have money for explosives, but not for bus routes. We have money for death, but not pavement. If that doesn't just kind of sober you up about where we are right now, well, may as well keep drinking. Because where we are right now is a mess. By the way, you remember, what was it, a week or so ago, we were talking about the fine, upstanding followers of the Prince of Peace who managed to light up a little measles mini-epidemic in Texas? Because, of course, they disagree with those satanic inoculations. It's not just measles anymore. Texas is presently experiencing what could very well be the worst whooping cough outbreak it has seen in 50 years, with 25% of the cases in Tarrant County, Texas. The Texas Department of State Health Services, which I'm surprised still exists, has even gone so far this past Tuesday as to issue a health alert, making sure that doctors are up to speed on how to diagnose and treat whooping cough, also known as pertussis. The doctors and other healthcare professionals are also supposed to urge Texans to re-up on their vaccines if it's been more than 10 years since they had one. See, most of us get a whooping cough vaccine when we're little, or at least if you're a certain age, you did. It comes in a sort of trifecta: diphtheria, pertussis, and typhus, or is it tuberculosis? I can't remember. The DPT shot, and then DPT booster. Most of us are probably walking around not immune to pertussis. Newborns in particular are at risk from whooping cough because, well, they just don't have the strength to do a whole lot of coughing, and they can wear out and die. As of August the 27th of this year, 1,935 people in Texas have been diagnosed with whooping cough. Fort Worth, Arlington area has around a quarter of the cases. 433 of them. They're down to teaching very simple things to the grown-ups who might be around babies. If you have a cough, stay away from babies. Now, that's going to be a little tough, however, if you've got to go over and lay the healing hands of faith on the baby. And you just coughed into your hand, and you lay the healing hands of faith on the little pumpkin, and well, there goes your faith healing. Thirty-eight cases in Tarrant County, Texas, have required hospitalization. 33 of those were infants. In 2009, the high of 3,358 cases of whooping cough was reached in Texas. That's 2009, not 1809. 2009, and they're expecting that these numbers will go higher. Dr. Lisa Cornelius of the Texas Department of State Health Services Infectious Disease Medical Officer said, "This is extremely concerning. If cases continue to be diagnosed at the current rate, we will see the most Texas cases since the 1950s. Two babies are already gone. They were under 2 months and too young to be vaccinated. Pregnant women should get a pertussis vaccine between 27 and 36 weeks, unless, of course, you go to Kenneth Copeland's daughter's church, where you will simply pray away the whooping cough, only not. It's airborne. You get it when people sneeze or cough. The article also notes that the Fort Worth area has also dealt with West Nile virus, measles, and a stomach bug called cyclosporiasis. Is it unfair to note that this is one of those free market wonderlands? Yeah. But luckily, we have enough money to be able to throw high explosives at people in Syria. Throwing high explosives at people in Syria, however, may not be the smartest thing to do. Our pal Cindy in the Great Northwest sent this along to me earlier today from the folks over at RT, which is the propaganda arm of the Russian government. Wasn't it fun when we just thought that RT was this progressive journalism outlet? Yeah, that was real kick. Russia, and it's one of those headlines that kind of makes you, what? Russia warns of nuclear disaster if Syria is hit. Whoa, I saw that. Well, they certainly upped the ante in a hurry, didn't they? But it wasn't what I thought. No, actually, the Russians are warning about the potential sort of Fukushima kind of situation, only self-inflicted. Well, not self-inflicted, because the Russian, because the Syrians aren't going to bomb themselves. It's going to be us, because, you know, our bombs never, ever go off target. No, they're smart. We have smart firecrackers. We have smart bottle rockets. We have smart Roman candles. Really big ones that cost about $1.4 million a piece. 100 of those. Yeah, what's 100? Yeah. RT reporting, a military strike on Syria could lead to a nuclear catastrophe if a missile were to hit a reactor containing radioactive uranium, a Russian foreign ministry spokesman warned. Okay. But, all right, but I mean, it's Syria, right? I mean, Israel has nuclear reactors. Israel enriches uranium and stuff like that and makes plutonium and has its own nuclear arsenal of well over 200 nuclear devices. But, I mean, you got to go all the way to Pakistan before you get to the next nuclear state, right? And then, you know, it's in the south to India. And I mean, we're not going to lob any, we're not going to be lobbing any cruise missiles at Israel or Pakistan or India. I mean, Syria? Really? Surely to goodness, if the Syrians had a nuclear reactor, we'd be having a purple polka dotted hissy and the chicken hawks would be out there. Wait a minute. Oops. Alexander Lukashevich said yesterday, "If warhead by design or by chance were to hit miniature neutron source reactor near Damascus, consequences could be catastrophic." What? The Syrians have a miniature neutron source reactor? Does that mean the neutrons are miniature or the reactor is? It's one of those problems with English and adjectives. Whatever it is, they said that the whole region could be at risk of, and I quote, contamination by highly enriched uranium, and it would no longer be possible to account for nuclear material, its safety and control. We will consider the questions raised if we receive such a request. So in other words, somewhere near Damascus, there is a miniature neutron source reactor that's cranking out enriched uranium. Where is that paragon of information, that light in the darkness, that life support system for a haircut? Oh, wait, it's not Iran. Never mind. Mark Hibbs from the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace told the Reuters news agency that it is a serious, a strike on the reactor would create a serious local radiation hazard. But we won't hit that. Because, I mean, we're just that good. It'll be surgical. Even though it won't. Yeah. Marty noting, right, Bob, the Patriot missile never missed, never misfired, and never went off course. No. Marty also noting, what's next down in Texas, a breakout of the mumps? Which, incidentally, I've never had, he says. I think there is a vaccine, and you might want to think about it. Marty noting, oh, and our buddy Israel isn't even a signatory of the Non-Proliferation Treaty. You know, like Iran is. Oopsie. Oh, they are interesting times, are they not? As we come up on the end of this first hour of the program, thanks going out to Sal and to Robert, another of our Roberts. Thank you very kindly. Sal took us down to 36 folks at $10 apiece, and Robert just took us down to 31 folks at $10 apiece. This can be done. This can be done. And it'll make leaving here and heading out to Wisconsin at an early, god-awful early hour of the morning considerably easier. Randy in PA with a question. Didn't Israel bomb that reactor many years ago using a computer virus to jam their radar? Is that the one? I don't know. What was it, a year or two ago? Jim pointing out, with regard to the Russians, they are angry and they are deadly serious, as nuclear contamination is well known to them. Believe me. I don't disbelieve. But we have a certain very, very wealthy contingent in this country who are damned well determined to get some missile on. Can somebody please, if there's somebody out there who is in favor of bombing the snot out of Syria, and it's bombing, whether it's by cruise missile or B-52 or what have you, still bombing. Can someone please explain to me what the goal is? Oh, well, that's easy, right? The goal is to make Bashar al-Assad quit using chemical weapons that he denies having used in the first place. And how is how are these limited surgical strikes going to do that? Now, we know how these limited surgical strikes are going to go about pissing the Russians off in a really, really large way. Oh, yes, we know. But I have yet to hear articulated a theory of how it's going to stop any more people from being gassed by Bashar al-Assad's forces or by, you know, the rebels who might be doing it too, else otherwise. So, I mean, that's kind of the sticky wicket for me. But it certainly is something fascinating to contemplate, and rather terrifying, I might add, this notion that we could, by having something go off course or miss its mark somehow, that we could accidentally sort of make a big portion of Damascus glow in the dark. Just trying to sort it out. Meanwhile, and I double-checked this story to make sure that it was fresh, that it wasn't from, you know, a couple of months back or something. You know that, and Darlene mentioned this to me in an email last night toward the end of the program. I had mentioned it in the previous evening, and I think I mentioned it at the beginning of the program last night, so by all means, let's mention it again. You know, of course, that in the middle of the deadly serious discussion of whether or not we should kill us some brown people, that the one who wants to bomb them the most, i.e. Bomber John McCain, screams at clouds, we know that he's been very vocal in saying that we've got to get our war on over there. Yeah. And we know, of course, that he was so serious about getting our war on over there that he sat in the Senate Foreign Relations Committee hearing and played Online Texas Hold'em, chuckling quietly to himself as he waited for that stray Jack to turn up in the river so he could have his Broadway straight. Yeah, 3 hours of Texas Hold'em. Well, Bomber John has proven to us that, yes, he is a very, very serious man. In the midst of all of this, and with the apparent obvious tensions that attend the opening of the G20 summit, which is presently underway in Petrograd, Bomber John McCain took the opportunity to appear on Chicken Noodle News's New Day program. New Day? Really? Nude Day? New Day? What? Please, no, Senator McCain, it's not Nude Day. Oh, gee, somebody hand him back his pants, will ya? No, once they got his pants back on, he looked back in the camera and said, "I was thinking this morning the worst thing you could do in the Old West was to steal another man's horse. I would think in New England the worst thing you can do is steal another man's Super Bowl ring." That's what Bomber John said on CNN's Nude Day. New Day. No. Don't unbutton your shirt, John. Really. In the middle of all of this, Bomber John, who seriously wants to seriously drop maybe a couple of $1 billion worth of munitions, and probably perhaps, I'm not at all crazy about this no boots on the ground thing. What the hell fun is a war if you're not over there to shoot some people? If I could still fly, I'd get up in the air and probably accidentally bomb a micronuclear neutron reactor. Damn, I bet that'd be one hell of an explosion. But this is very serious business, and we've got to stop that brutal dictator, Bashar al-Assad. But by the way, will somebody please make Pooty Poot give back Robert Kraft's ring? Really? I'm not kidding? This cranky old coot in the middle of some serious eyeball to eyeball staring down contest brought up the issue of Robert Kraft's Super Bowl ring. I was kidding. You know, we've got to support the Free Syrian Army and send them some bazookas and rocket launchers and maybe a couple of those newfangled. And you know what? I don't care if we burn this planet to a cinder. We're getting Robert Kraft's Super Bowl ring back because this is America. One wonders if that'll be part of the articles of impeachment. And on the fourth day of September 2013, the said Barack Obama did speak with the said Vladimir Putin, and the said Barack Obama did fail to retrieve for our nation's honor and dignity, and again, and against the tenets of his oath, Robert Kraft's Super Bowl effing ring. Too much. Too much. So the ability of Americans to go on eating food hangs in the balance. The paving of roads hangs in the balance. The ability of people to get health care hangs in the balance. The deficit hawks have been screaming about the way that Barack Obama spends money like a drunken Kenyan sailor. We're gonna rain some death and destruction on Syria. Maybe $1 billion worth or more. Billion with a B. Thank you very kindly, Sylvia. Sylvia just took us down to 29 folks. At $10 a piece to finish fundraising for this evening. It can be done. Thank you. Thank you, Sylvia. Brian and Sylvia and Robert and Henry, all showing the way. Thank you. You know, with things like this in the news today, it makes you kind of wonder. just what in the is going to be in the Green News Report this evening? We're about to find out. Sure enough, we are about to find out. Because it's on the way after we take a break. Plenty more stuff to cuss and discuss. Your calls are also always welcome. You know the number, 304-658-3333. And you can also get through on the Skype line. The contact here, contact address is Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. That's how you get through on Skype. Email BobKincaid@gmail.com, @BobKincaid on Twitter. And if you feel absolutely compelled, you can just stand outside and holler. I don't know if I'll hear it, but you know, plenty of ways to reach the program. If you wish to do so. A break, and then back with your calls or more stuff to make you, more stuff to just make you scream. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn.
Constantinople, now Istanbul, now Constantinople, been a long time gone. Boston of Shillyway in Istanbul. Even old New York was once New Amsterdam. Why they changed it, I can't say.
People just liked it better that way.
So take me back to Constantinople. No, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the works? That's nobody's business but the Turks.
It's Thursday, September 5, 2013.
We are facing record fuel, dry conditions across this state.
Yeah, no, it wasn't a pot farm that caused the massive Yosemite Rim fire.
The goal of achieving a carbon neutral economy is remarkable, and Sweden is well on its way.
Sweden's focus on clean energy already reaping benefits. It's official, hottest winter on record for New Zealand. It's confirmed. Fracking injection wells caused Ohio earthquake. Plus,
students headed back to class for the start of the school year yesterday as the heat started settling in.
Too hot for school?
Yes, always too hot for school. All of that and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
And I would like a memo to go out this week to this company that global warming is a pile of crap.
Thanks for that helpful point, Glenn Beck. Your great-grandchildren thank you even more. This is your Green News Report.
Load of socialist communist crap.
Okay, Desi Doyen, as we swelter out here in California for 2 weeks going, I'm going to ignore Glenn Beck and look up to the Yosemite fire up north. What? It wasn't started by stoners on a pot farm?
No, it wasn't.
But CBS told me that it was.
People living near the massive Yosemite fire are allowed back in their homes this morning, but a local fire chief suspects an illegal marijuana farm is to blame.
What evidence does he have for that?
No, there is no evidence for it. It was not caused by an illegal marijuana grow operation, as one fire official suspected earlier in the week. The U.S. Forest Service on Thursday said it appears to have been accidentally started by a hunter who ignored widespread burn bans and built a campfire in the Tinder Dry National Forest in the driest year in California history that has burned nearly 400 square miles and destroyed 11 homes.
So it was a hunter, not a stoner.
That's right. And remember, folks, what Smokey Bear tells you.
Only you can prevent forest fires.
Stoners.
It's confirmed yet another geological study finds a spate of earthquakes near Youngstown, Ohio since 2011 were indeed induced by fracking wastewater injection wells. That's the second half of the fracking process, which requires disposing of millions of gallons of toxic wastewater injected into deep underground wells, which causes faults to slip, creating earthquakes in regions that never had them before.
Every time we cover this story, it blows me away that we are causing earthquakes, and that seems to be okay with everybody.
And they're thinking about doing it here in Earthquake, California.
What could possibly go wrong?
In a press conference with Sweden's prime minister in advance of the G20 meeting this week, President Obama says we've got a lot we could learn.
Sweden is obviously an extraordinary leader when it comes to tackling climate change, and the goal of achieving a carbon neutral economy is remarkable, and Sweden is well on its way.
Most of Sweden's electricity comes from renewable and clean energy sources because they made one major policy shift 2 decades ago. They established a carbon tax. and yet it didn't crash their economy, as some people say would happen here in the U.S.
By some people, you mean the fossil fuel industry and the politicians and liars who are funded by them.
Exactly. It's official. New Zealand, down under in the southern hemisphere, just had its warmest winter on record. And in Australia, which also just had its warmest winter on record, the past 12 months have been the hottest 12 months in Australia for more than 100 years. These new records are in line with climate scientists' predictions that global warming would bring an increase in record extreme weather events.
Yeah, but remember what Glenn Beck says.
Global warming is a pile of crap.
Huh, I could say the same thing about Glenn Beck.
Oh, meow.
The heat is on and it's impacting schools in the U.S.
Students headed back to class for the start of the school year yesterday as the heat started settling in across Chicago, making it a little difficult to get back into the swing of things.
Associated Press reports that for the first time, school closures due to excessive heat are becoming more common, almost as common as closures for snow days, because many older schools in northern states simply do not have air conditioning.
But remember,
load of socialist communist crap.
But some good news, Chile, driven by increasing drought, has perfected the art of harvesting fresh drinking water from fog using fog catchers that are made of mesh or wire that capture condensation as fog moves over them. They've figured out the best configuration, materials, and location to squeeze water from fog.
So it's like those moisture farms on Tatooine in Star Wars?
Exactly.
Very cool. For much more on that and the other stories we didn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. While you're there, don't forget we count on you to sponsor the Green News Report. For some reason, those companies who put all those millions of dollars into fracking don't want to help us out. So hopefully you will. Find us and like us on the Facebook and follow us 24/7 on the Twitters at Green News Report. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Driving around from one end of this town to the other and back, but no one's ever seen us driving our Econoline van, and no one's ever heard of our band. We're the Mesopotamians, Sargon, Hammurabi, Ashurman, Appel, and Gilgamesh. Then they wouldn't understand a word we say, so we'll scratch it all down into the clay, half believing there will sometime come a day someone gives a damn. Maybe when the concrete has crumbled to the sand, we're the Mesopotamians, Sargon, Hammurabi, Ashurman, Appel, and Gilgamesh. The Mesopotamish sun is beating down and making cracks in the ground, but there's nowhere else to stand in Mesopotamia. The kingdom where we secretly reign, the land where we invisibly rule as the Mesopotamians, Sargon, Hammurabi, Ashurman, Appel, and Gilgamesh. This is my last stick of gum. I'm going to cut it up so everybody else gets some. Except for Ashurman, Appel, who says my haircut makes me look like a Mohenjo-Daro. Hey, Ashurman, Appel, I'm a Mesopotamian. Sargon, Hammurabi, Ashurman, Appel, and Gilgamesh. I'm not afraid to
meh. Kind of a little they might be giants kick there. First was Istanbul, not Constantinople, and that from the latest track, or from their latest album, the last album, they might be giants and the Mesopotamians. Dr. John sent that along, and well, how can you not play a song like that? I mean, we needed a bumper out of the Green News Report anyway. 21 minutes past the hour. I love smart music. I just do. And, I mean, come on. Come on. Can we take a poll? Does anybody think that Robin Thicke can even say Ashurbanipal, let alone spell it? No, me neither. Not that I'm getting all geezery, but I mean, there's music and there's music. And bless their hearts, they might be giants have been, good God, how long have they been catchy? First album, what, 88? 1988? Yeah, 25 years. Wow! And they're still doing this? Like Dr. John said a little bit ago, every now and then there are little flashes of hope. Sargon, Hammurabi, Ashurbanipal, and Gilgamesh. Awesome. Just awesome. It's Thorn in the Side Thursday. This is the Horn. Note coming in from Jack in Shreveport regarding the Green News Report. And you just know that the hunter in that story about starting the rim fire, that was, and then the fact that it was blamed on an illegal marijuana farm, you just know that that hunter was a law-abiding gun owner. Yeah, or as I like to spell it, parenthesis, L, close parenthesis, A-W-F-U-L, gun owner. A lawful, awful gun owner. Nice. Nice. Yeah, thanks for burning down a whole bunch of California, you lawful gun owner, you. Well, you know, when starting forest fires is outlawed, oh, stop it. But you get the idea. I get the little annoying email every day from Salon telling me what's on their page. And I read an article there earlier today, and this goes back to some of the stuff Brad and Desi were talking about. There is, among our group and outside it, a tremendous amount of respect accorded to Naomi Klein. She, of course, being the person who coined the phrase disaster capitalism, which in its turn sort of explains just about everything we're witnessing that is bad on the planet today. But Salon did a reprint of an article from Earth Island Journal, an interview by Jason Mark with Naomi Klein, and the headline reads as follows. Naomi Klein, : Green groups may be more damaging than climate change deniers. And I am definitely prone to being, it was bow season? Duncan just telling me, it was bow season, Bob. Rifle season has not started yet. So so Jack, in answer to your question, the hunter was a bow hunter? Okay. Very interesting. So maybe it wasn't a lawful gun owner. But then again, I don't know about California, but in these parts, the stated beginning of any given season is often taken by the diehard hunters around here as being advisory at best. So, hard to say. But apparently, yes, a hunter started that. Jesus. Not a bunch of dope heads. But no, when I see a headline like, green groups may be more damaging than climate change deniers, my pink little ears perk up. And not just curiosity, but Wondering if I'm going to wind up agreeing. Because, again, Naomi Klein is a brilliant individual. So you can find this over at Salon or at Earth Island Journal, where it originated. And here's the crux of what Naomi Klein has to say. She says, for starts, that as the Cold War dwindled, environmentalism became the next target, the next communism for the right wing. Now the movement at that stage could have responded in one of two ways. It could have fought back and defended the values it stood for at that point and tried to resist the steamroller that was neoliberalism in its early days, or it could have adapted itself to this new reality and changed itself to fit the rise of corporatist government. And it did the latter, very consciously, if you read what Environmental Defense Fund President Fred Krupp was saying at the time. We now understand it's about corporate partnerships. It's not sue the bastards, it's work through corporate partnerships with the bastards. There is no enemy anymore. And then she points out, and some of this stuff is hard to swallow. Some of this stuff is just really, really, really difficult to not get your head around, but to sort of take in as having elements of fact, let alone truth. Naomi Klein says, I go back to something even like the fight over NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. The big green groups, with very few exceptions, lined up in favor of NAFTA, despite the fact that their memberships were revolting, and sold the deal very aggressively to the public. That's the model that has been globalized through the World Trade Organization, and that is responsible in many ways for the levels of soaring emissions. We've globalized an utterly untenable economic model of hyper-consumerism. It's now successfully spreading across the world, and it's killing us. And now you know why I ran off to read Waltzing at the Doomsday Ball this morning. It's just a little, you know, a little booster shot of Joe Bajant every once in a while, because I can understand that there was something about Joe Bajant that just made him comprehensible, made you comfortable with him, the way he wrote. But he's talking about the same thing, hyper-consumerism. And she continues, Naomi Klein does, it's not that the green groups were spectators to this. They were partners in this. They were willing participants in this. It's not every green group. It's not Greenpeace. It's not Friends of the Earth. It's not, for the most part, notice the qualifier, the Sierra Club. It's not 350.org, who didn't even exist yet. But it goes back to the elite roots of the movement. And the fact that when a lot of these conservation groups began, there was a kind of noblesse oblige approach to conservation. I think we even touched on this the other night. Who was it that pointed out that John Muir was talking about saving forests that had been successfully saved for millennia until white folks got here in the first place? Somebody, conversation we had just the other night. I think it goes back to the elite roots of the movement and the fact that when a lot of these conservation groups began, there was a kind of noblesse oblige approach to conservation. It was about elites getting together and hiking and deciding to save nature. And then the elites changed. So if the environmental movement was going to decide to fight, they would have had to give up their elite status. And they weren't willing to give up their elite status. I think that's a huge part, Naomi Klein says, of the reason why emissions, for instance, are where they are. And this is worth reading, tweeting around, Facebooking, whatever, because it's real. And Naomi Klein has cut right through to the crux of the matter. And I'm not going to sit here and read it all the way through like I did with V.D. Hansen the other day. But among other things, when asked, you've said that the progressive narratives are insufficient. What would be an alternative narrative to turn this situation around? She says, I think the narrative that got us into this, that's part of the reason why you have climate change denialism being as powerful a force in North America and in Australia as it is really tied to the frontier mentality. By the way, you heard the Becker head in the Green News Report, which is why I came straight to this story. It's a pile of bull! Yeah. It's really tied to the frontier mentality, the denialism. It's really tied to the idea that there always being more. We live on lands that were supposedly innocent, discovered, you hear the quotation marks? Discovered lands where nature was so abundant, you could not imagine depletion ever. These are foundational myths. I mean, this is 19 levels of brilliant, powerful, factual, and for somebody who doesn't throw the word around very much, truth. Indeed, truth. Naomi Klein continues, I've taken a huge amount of hope from the emergence of the Idle No More movement. And you know what Idle No More is. It's the native-led movement that began in Canada and is working its way into the United States with native groups saying, no, been run over enough, going to be idle no more. We're going to oppose these attempts to ruin whatever last remnant there is of the stuff that was good and decent for us for millennia. We're going to stop it. I've taken a huge amount of hope from the emergence of the Idle No More movement because of what I see as a tremendous generosity of spirit from indigenous leadership right now to educate us in another narrative. She says, I just did a panel with Idle No More, and I was the only non-native speaker at this event, and the other native speakers were all saying we want to play this leadership role. It's actually taken a long time to get to that point. There's been so much abuse heaped upon these communities and so much rightful anger at the people who stole their lands. This is the first time that I've seen this openness, open willingness, that we have something to bring. We want to lead. We want to model another way which relates to the land. So that's where I'm getting a lot of hope right now. And I share that sentiment. I too sat on a panel, this one in northern Wisconsin, where I was the only non-native. And I was welcomed and accorded respect. And in turn, I tried to make clear that my job was not to be, you know, any kind of director of what anyone should do, but merely to share what our experience has been here in Appalachia with mountaintop removal, so that it could be used as a prism through which we might view what is planned in northern Wisconsin for the Pinokies by a badass hillbilly by the name of mean-ass hillbilly by the name of Chris Klein. And I came away from there more inspired than I have been in a very, very long time. In fact, it had been my goal, but it just didn't work out that way. It had been my goal to actually drive to Wisconsin. I had hoped what I wanted to do was just go straight north up through Ohio, straight up through Michigan, across the UP, and into Wisconsin, spend a little bit of time. I want to see the Lac Coeur d'Alene harvest camp so badly up in the Pinokies, but it just hasn't worked out and didn't work out. But then I was going to come on down to Madison for Fighting Bob and then zoom on home and brave the perils of the various and sundry bypasses out around Chicago, and yeah, you get the idea. But it didn't happen. Kind of had to be here. No kind of about it. Really had to be here. But I still remain deeply inspired by what I've personally experienced going on in northern Wisconsin. And by the way, now we know what you have to do if you want to get a law pushed through to blow the snot out of a perfectly good line of hills that are an absolute clean water, clean air, clean land wonderland. What you got to do is you got to pay a bunch of money to utterly, wholly, completely, entirely corrupt right-wing politicians. Because that's what happened. Tons of money was paid into campaign coffers in order to get the law through that would theoretically clear the way for the blasting of the Pinocchio Hills and the poisoning of the people who live near it, the ruination of the watershed, the absolute degradation of the waterways, the elimination of the ancient food gathering technologies and traditions. All you got to do is give a lot of money to some dirty ass Republican politicians. Bingo. The only thing they didn't count on was the fact that they can give all the money they want, but there are people there who are not interested in how much money gets paid, but are instead interested in protecting themselves and their lands and their families. Set all the way to seven generations into the future. Yeah, that mean-ass hillbilly has no idea who he's messing with up in northern Wisconsin. So I will see some of my buddies from northern Wisconsin when I show up at Fighting Bob on Saturday. I can't wait. I'm really excited. There will be great speakers at Fighting Bob, but the chance to reconnect with people that I see making real change on the ground, doing the work of the grassroots, that's going to be big. In this interview with Naomi Klein, she says something that, well, I just sat up on it. Whoa! You know, little splash of ice water, you know, a little cold water on the back of the neck in the code. Toward the end of the interview, she says, "I think the big green groups are becoming deeply irrelevant. Some get a lot of money from corporations and rich donors and foundations, but their whole model is in crisis." Of course, the only issue I took with that is a matter of verb tense. Naomi Klein says, "I think the big green groups are becoming deeply irrelevant." I would say it differently. I think the big green groups have become deeply irrelevant. When you consider, for instance, the coal campaign run by the Sierra Club, and yeah, this is personal to me. I'm not trying to be vicious or vindictive, but I am going to be realistic. When you consider the Sierra Club's coal campaign, which at least at one point in time still had references to mountaintop removal on its website, it's called Beyond Coal. When you consider the fact that Michael Bloomberg, oh wait, there's one of those elites Naomi Klein was talking about. Well, roll me in flour and call me oyster. When you consider the Beyond Coal campaign that Michael Bloomberg gave, to whom Michael Bloomberg gave $50 million. And when you consider the fact that those of us on the ground doing the work here in Appalachia reached out directly to the person who runs that Beyond Coal campaign and said, "Listen, we don't want a whole bunch, but we'd like enough help to be able to make sure that we can make the rent payment in Washington D.C. and maybe every now and then afford a ham hock to go in the beans that we eat up there." We were told no. We were told, "You know, we really don't think this is a good time to be introducing legislation to stop mountaintop removal that will keep you good-for-nothing hillbillies alive. We will call on you when it is time for you to come out and do your hillbilly dancing, and then you will sit down until we need you again. And if you happen to die along the way, we'll find someone else to dance." Because that's what they do. Whether it's Larry Gibson or Judy Bonds or any of a variety of other people who have gone on, who have been used relentlessly by people like the Sierra Club. When they're done with you, they're done with you. And they start looking for somebody else to exploit. Because, you see, they don't have independent relevance. The relevance is in the grassroots. So, for instance, with the AIC Act, AIC Act.org, everything that's happened in the AIC Act has largely been a function, with a couple of notable exceptions. We get tremendous logistical support from our friends at Earth Justice, and we love them dearly. But beyond that, if it's been done, a little handful of us have done it. The AIC campaign operates under the aegis of Coal River Mountain Watch. I can't tell you the last time Coal River Mountain Watch saw a check come from the Sierra Club. The Sierra Club does, however, fund lawsuits, and I know this is a little bit weedy, but you know, you guys deserve to know this kind of stuff. The Sierra Club funds lawsuits against mining companies that have already been found out and admitted to having, for instance, discharged pollutants into streams. So all the work's been done, so the Sierra Club funds the lawsuit gets filed, and because they've already been stone cold busted, the coal company enters into what's called a settlement agreement or a memorandum of understanding that agrees to pay a certain amount of money in fines and attorney's fees. And then they get to go on doing mountaintop removal, and it doesn't stop it. None of it is ever going to stop mountaintop removal. The only thing out there that's going to stop mountaintop removal is the AIC Act, which grassroots hillbillies came up with. My son was in the room the day the AIC Act was born. So was I. So was Bo Webb. The Sierra Club wasn't there. The Sierra Club told us that it was a bad idea to try to get a law that would stop the coal companies from poisoning our loved ones, our friends, our neighbors to death. This is our reality. I think the Sierra Club has put out one email and maybe one blog post in almost 2 years in support of the AIC Act. One. Now, they have... They've sent out Preserve Our Clean Water emails, and they have used people, they're very good at using people here in this region as the faces of their requests for people to write to the EPA. But the one piece of legislation that would just end mountaintop removal, bupkis. So if you happen to get those Sierra Club emails from time to time saying, won't you please help us save the wolfuses and we'll send you a Sierra Club messenger bag, please don't. Because all that money is used for is to exploit grassroots activists. Period. And to further the largely elitist agenda of a bunch of people who are never, ever, ever going to breathe ultra-fine particulate matter blowing off of a mountaintop removal site, who, unlike Larry Gibson, are never, ever going to die with a weed eater in their hands trying to trim up the weeds on top of the last part of a mountain that he had struggled all his life to save. They will never, ever know the fears that attend the end of life for a hero like Judy Bonds, for whom we had to struggle to maintain insurance coverage so that she could die with some dignity and her family not be absolutely destroyed by the medical bills. The elites of the so-called Big Greens will never know any of that. And I don't walk around just looking to pick fights. Hell, I've gone to Sierra Club activities. I've stuck my neck out on the line for them. I've danced when I was told to dance. But this hillbilly ain't dancing no more. Mm-mm. No. Hell no. So let me just say this. And I say this in the midst, of course, of the constant fundraising that we have to do just to keep this effort on the air. Because you're it. You and what we pull out of our own pockets are it here. But let me say this. If you see one of those solicitations from one of the Big Greens show up in your email inbox, and you are even remotely inclined to answer it and give them some of your money, stop. And go immediately either to acact.org or crmw.net and contribute whatever you were going to give them there. Because the one thing you know for damn sure is if it goes into the Ake Act or Coal River Mountain Watch, it will go directly toward an attempt to stop something that is killing and tormenting and poisoning people. You cannot say that about the Sierra Club, where executive salaries run in excess of six figures. That $15 or whatever that you have to send to get the Sierra messenger bag, that goes as much into maintaining a $250,000 salary for the executive director as it does to saving any goddamn wolves. So yeah, my only difference with Naomi Klein is to say that I think the Big Green groups have become deeply irrelevant. It was in Las Vegas at Netroots Nation a few years back when Big Green leaders said, oh no, the environmental movement will never be a great agent for social change like the civil rights movement was. Never. When in fact the reason that there's a Clean Water Act and a Clean Air Act has to do with the fact that millions upon millions of people took to the streets on the very first Earth Day in 1970, and that out of that movement of people in the streets came the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and the Environmental Protection Agency. That simple. There are bigger greens that are doing good work, and some are just self-perpetuating. You can find this article at Earth Island Journal, and under the headline at Salon, Naomi Klein, green groups may be more damaging than climate change deniers. And they become more damaging, if I understand the article correctly, when they become corporatist, when they decide that there is more to be had by participating in a system that is inherently corrupt and consumptive than in talking about real change. For God's sakes, I remember telling Preston the other night, a few weeks back, about how the Sierra Club went hand in hand with the frackers in Illinois to create a law that would permit fracking in Illinois when the grassroots were saying, no, hell no, stop it. We want to continue to live. We don't want to be poisoned to death by these people. And the so-called brilliant people said, well, you little people just don't understand. Naomi Klein in the article also points out the fact that Natural Resources Defense Council, Sierra Club, and a couple others, without so much as a by your leave to the people who are facing the risks and doing the work on the ground, declared that frack gas was a bridge fuel to that great getting up morning when all the energy is going to be from wind and solar. And so consequently, now, in places like Pennsylvania and West Virginia, fracking has turned water into a nightmare. In Texas, 30 towns are facing their own ruin because their aquifers have been drained out by the frackers. Yeah, right, Larry, Stockton Larry in the chat room. Well, Bob, they support the good fracking, you know? Ain't no good fracking. Thanks very kindly to Mark. Mark just took up four slots in the fundraising this evening. Takes us down to 25. 25 folks needed now at $10 a piece to get us over the fundraising hump till Monday. It's important. Thank you, Mark. Thank you kindly. I hope others will follow Mark and follow Samantha. Thank you, Samantha. Follow Brian. Follow Robert. Follow Henry. Thank you, all of you, for this evening. Thank you, Mr. Gibson. Mr. Gibson signed up for a subscription. There's a subscription button over at headonradionetwork.com, and if you want to just pick out an amount of money, fill it in, it'll just happen every month, and you don't have to worry about it. But if you can't, but believe me, and I can't. I understand. So, goodness gracious, here we are, 7 minutes before the hour, and this has become a two-hour filibobster. And I don't necessarily favor that. What with me being gone tomorrow and the following Friday. No Fridays on the front porch coming, so this is, you know, in case you've got a burr under your saddle or a bee under your bonnet and there's something you got to get off your chest, this is pretty much your last chance. Well, I mean, until Monday. Monday and Tuesday we'll have programs. But nothing for tomorrow. Again, a reminder, I will try to stream the proceedings from Fighting Bob if that is at all humanly possible. You know the number, 304-658-3333. On the Skype line is Bob Kincaid Horn, B-O-B-K-I-N-C-A-I-D-H-O-R-N. And it is fascinating, and you can't get away from Syria, can we? Even though it's pretty obvious that there are no answers here. Only questions. But good God. A quote from highfalutin, repiglican Ileana Ros-Leitanen.
It is against the norms of international standards, and to let something like this go unanswered,
meaning chemical attacks in Syria,
I think we'll weaken our resolve.
Yeah, we're all just going to say F it and sit there in our easy chairs. And
I know that President Reagan would never have let this happen. He would stand up to this.
Oh, that's precious. Of course, it was President Reagan and his administration that clued the Iraqis in on where to use the chemical weapons to gas the Iranians. It was Ronald Reagan and his pals that sold the chemical weapons to the Iraqis in the first place. And sold some to the Iranians, too. And, well, traded some arms for hostages to the Iranians. But, yeah, there I go fooling around with facts again. Huh.
I know that President Reagan would never have let this happen. He would stand up to this. And President Obama, the only reason he's consulting with Congress, he wants to blame somebody for his lack of resolve. Sister, he stands on stage and makes jokes while people deemed to be enemies of the state are getting bullets put through their hearts and brains.
Lack of resolve. He's got all the resolve he needs to go out and bomb some brown people.
And we have to think like President Reagan would do, and he would say, chemical use is unacceptable unless we're telling people where to use the chemicals against people we don't like. Mommy, ketchup is a vegetable. No, I am.
But the fact of the matter is, it raises a larger question, and I really do. I welcome your input on this, your discussion, your conversation, via email or however. And by the way, our buddy Michael, writing from Sebastopol, says, Reagan cut and ran, I mean dead ran, out of Lebanon. Well, there's that, too. Of course, he kept some 200 Marines from being able to run anywhere. They sort of died in their tracks in the barracks there that they didn't have to be in, where they could have been safely aboard ship and taken to anywhere they needed. You know, right, being Marines. No, he had to show the flag and... never mind. Thank you, Karen. Thank you very kindly. Making progress here. 23 folks, no, 24 folks at $10 a piece, and we'll be done for the evening. But really, like I said, I welcome your thoughts on this. The posturing about chemical weapons is a position that we initially reached when they were first used in the Great War, the war to end all wars, the war that Woodrow Wilson said would make the world safe for democracy. Larger question, of course, being whether democracy is safe for the world. Because democracy does not always mean benign. I know I've hammered on it quite a bit, but remember, the democracy killed Socrates, and Plato never forgave him for that. The democracy did all kinds of stuff in Athens. It was not benign. But anyway, our attitudes toward chemical weapons were shaped in the aftermath of the First World War when a tired and horrified world had to confront not only the losses, the deaths from the use of chemical weapons, but had to also deal with those who came home having survived their use and were maimed into one degree or another forevermore. And there was a general consensus that even in the midst of all the horror and carnage and bloodshed that is warfare, that this was just a weapon too far. Now, these consensi were reached before ever the United States decided to drop two atomic weapons on civilian populations in Japan, which added another element to the list of, holy shit, here's another thing we don't ever want anybody else doing. But the thought experiment that I would like to engage in is to contemplate whether or not whether or not our alleged treaties on the topic of chemical weapons are rational. Not whether they are well-intended. The road to hell is paved with good intentions. And bones, and flesh, and heartache and grief. But good intentions. Whether it's rational. And by that I mean, if we take rather a, and since I'm not one, I use the term, chemical warfare has it worked? I mean, granted, we weren't lobbing nerve gas at each other or mustard gas during the Second World War. I suspect that's because Germany was using all that it could produce to run, you know, to run the death camps. Zyklon B, anybody? Yeah. And we knew that in time we could simply outgun and outbullet the Third Reich. The Russians had more bodies to throw at bullets than the Germans had bullets to throw at the bodies. And the manufacturing juggernaut that was a United States emerging from depression could not be touched, could not be reached, could not be impeded. So it became just a matter of mathematical calculation as to how long it would take for the Reich to fall. But where the actual proscription on the use of chemical weapons is concerned, is it substantive or is it speculative? Is it something to which we are really committed, or is it something that is more of a function of our own wishful thinking? Because if you look at the Iran-Iraq war, not only did the United States not try to rally the world to intervene in that conflagration, we actively encouraged and provided, we encouraged the use of, provided the means of, and even offered up the logistical support for the use of chemical weapons. We did that. And do not think for an instant that our enemies or our friends didn't know we were doing it. And then there's Agent Orange. Well, Bob, that wasn't chemical warfare. I mean, that was just a defoliant to kill off all the jungle so we could see those godforsaken NVA and VC running all over the place, right? But it sure did serve as a chemical weapon. And, interestingly enough, it served as a chemical weapon in the same way that chemical weapons did. Because one of the reasons you don't want to use chemical weapons from a military standpoint is one good shift in the wind, and you haven't gassed your enemy, you've gassed yourself. Right? Yeah. But I can't find any evidence of the world consensus that was said to be required to stop the use of chemical weapons from actually working. Now, when we want to gin up a phony baloney, dummied up, faked up, rubed up, ginned up war, we will, as we did in Iraq, we will claim that the possession of chemical weapons constitutes casus belli, but it damn sure didn't constitute casus belli back when we were supporting the Iraqis against the Iranians. Now, did it? Not hardly. No, it didn't. So there's the question. Are we having this debate on terms that are not legitimate? Are we having a debate that is based upon a faulty premise, which means that everything flowing from the faulty premise is going to be equally faulty? And I think we're kind of living in a fool's paradise if we think that we aren't. The intervention in the use of chemical weapons is something that, by definition, must be done by a significant portion of world consensus, and we ain't got it. And the reason we ain't got it is because we can't be trusted. The United States in the world community cannot be trusted to tell the truth. Because the whole damned world understands that the business of America is business. And if we see a profit in unloading a couple of $100 million worth of cruise missiles on Syria, we'll do it. And the facts be damned. This seems abundantly clear to me. And so what I'm asking then is whether this whole so-called national debate is just moot, or whether that majority of the American people who do not wish to intervene understand the flim-flammery involved with this more than the people inside the Beltway, who apparently sit around with a grenade in one hand and masturbate with the other. I don't know. Very interesting indeed. By the way, I'm going to take a little break here. If you're on hold, please stay that way. I need to do something to get the stream back going again. I need to drop a note to Ben because we've lost our ability to reach the server. So just stand by a minute, please. This is Conversation Radio. This is The Horn. Okay, so here's what happened. I'm informed by Ben Birch that the entirety of the entire server company that hosts the White Rose Society servers and hosts the Head On Radio Network stream website crashed. I mean, the whole kit and caboodle. So, consequently, we crashed. And that's why the live stream stopped. Obviously, we can continue recording. But here at 27 minutes past the hour, well, to be quite honest, I'm going to knock off. I'm going to take 30 minutes early, and that gives me 30 more minutes to finish getting packed and double-check all my stuff and make sure that everything is squared away for getting up entirely too early in the morning and going and getting on yonder aeroplane. So I will hopefully talk with you all come Monday. Moran Monday will be around for us on Monday the 9th. It is the 9th, isn't it? Yeah, Monday the 9th of September. I look forward to it. Until then, have a great weekend. Bye now.